Secondary's market transaction volume reached around the $110 billion mark in 2023, representing the second highest year for volume on record. The devil's in the details. I'm Madeline Farman, a senior reporter with Secondary's Investor. I'm joined by my colleagues Adam Lay, our senior editor, and our Americas correspondent, Hannah Zhang. We dug through this year's advisory reports to find some of the key trends underpinning the secondaries market last year and delve into what this could mean for secondaries deal flow in 2024. Total deal volume sat somewhere in the region of $109 billion and $115 billion last year. That's an increase on 2022 figures, when deal volume reached around $102 billion and $111 billion. I realise that the sort of top and bottom figure of that sort of range could make it sound like deal volume looked stagnant year over year, but each one of the reports shows a marked increase. I'm just giving the sort of aggregated numbers here. So LP-led deal volume made up the bulk of activity last year, reaching somewhere in the region of $56 billion and $66 billion. So some quite wide dispersion with some of the figures there. GP-leds reached around $45 billion and $52 billion of volume.
And lastly, secondaries firms have dry powder of between $136 billion and $176 billion.
I think it's worth noting three of the reports show there's around $170 billion of capital to deploy into secondaries deals. So yes, strong figures last year, certainly not a record-breaking year, but there was definitely a plethora of activities, and I know we've been covering them very, very closely. And I think, most importantly, there was a lot of demand for secondaries capital last year. So, you know, those lucky buyers, they get the pick of the bunch.
They certainly do, Maddie. I mean, there's so much to unpack from the numbers that you just read out, and we've got so many reports to get through. Hannah, let's dig into a bit of the weeds here. You've been reading through the Lazard report, haven't you?
Yes, Adam. So what caught my eyes first was that there was a geographic shift in the GP Latin market. And let's start with North America. Although it's been leading in the GP Latin market, it made up 68% of the market last year. And that was a 5 percentage point increase from 2022. And on the flip side, Asia and the rest of the world took a bit of a hit. So according to the report, deal volume there was down 4 percentage points to 28% last year. And the advisor attributed the increasing market share in North America to the geopolitical pressure and macro uncertainty in Europe and Asia. And very interestingly, it specifically pointed out that the weakening activity in China has been a major headwind for the secondaries market in Asia. So that's the first eye-catching finding in Lazard's annual report. And second, it found that buyouts gained 4 percentage points of market share in 2023, accounting for 86% of the market. And Lazard thinks that's because investors prefer having control and like assets that are mature and stable. It's all about going for the sure thing.
And you spoke with Lazard's head of private capital advisory, Holcomb Green, didn't you, Hannah? What did he have to say about global deal flow, and what did he say about GP leads?
Yes, that's right. So in terms of GP leads, there were a couple of things that Holcomb found interesting. One was that the kind of fund financing end of the market shrank by a fair amount and was effectively replaced by additional continuation fund activity. And he attributed that largely to the high interest rate environment. For example, preferred equity and other structured solutions saw a 5 percentage point decrease in deal volume, making up only 14% of the market last year. And the second was pricing. It is quite strong across the market today and improved quite significantly through the year on the GP side. About 70% of transactions were priced at 90% of NAV or better. And on the LP side, pricing for buyouts also started to exceed 90% of NAV in the second half of the year.
Really interesting statistics, Hannah. You mentioned, I guess, North America taking a larger share of deals last year, according to Lazard's report. And you talked about, I guess, some sort of uncertainty in areas like in Asia, for example. You spent some time in Asia in the last few weeks and months. What kind of takeaways did you get when you were there and kind of speaking to APAC secondaries market participants?
Yeah, so I spent some time in Hong Kong and mainland China in the past couple of weeks. So deal volume there, as mentioned before, was down in the APAC region. I think the gloomy market sentiment is especially evident in a GP-led market, particularly in China. So buyers I spoke to told me that discount in the RMB GP-leds, which is the local currency GP-leds, can go down to as much as 80% of NAV. But even with such a huge discount, it's hard to strike a deal. And almost every buyer I spoke to in the RMB secondaries market emphasized that they only want to partner with the best quality GPs. And in China, that means the very top three or top five managers. But buyers still do think the GP-led market in China has a lot of room to grow. And that's because the Chinese PE market boomed in the 2014-2015 period, and lots of funds are approaching the end of their life cycles. And because of this, there's a great demand for liquidity, and Chinese GPs in general are open to creative strategies, not just fund recapitalization, but also preferred equity, tender offer, and other types of solutions. So enough about APAC. Let's talk more about Evercore's report, which I've also had a look into. And one interesting takeaway from Evercore is that although fundraising has been challenging in the past year, the dry powder levels in the secondaries market are at historical high, and that's mostly fueled by large fundraises by big secondary investors like Ardian and Lexington. Maddie, you've been following some of the biggest fundraises, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've had the pleasure and joy of finding, come across my desk, these record-breaking fundraisers. So we obviously had the news in January that Lexington had closed Lexington Capital Partners 10 at $22.7 billion, which significantly surpassed its $15 billion target. It also surpasses our last record holder, Blackstone, which raised $22.2 billion in January last year, or at least that's when we heard the news announced off the top of my head, for Fund 9. So Lexington gets in with that record by a hair's breadth, which I'm sure they're thrilled about. We've also seen some other funds close this year. So 2024 off to a flying start. Nowhere near, obviously, as big as those record-breaking fundraisers, but Committed Advisors secured 2.6 billion euros for their latest secondaries fund. Banner Ridge closed on its latest fund on $2.15 billion. And Hannah, maybe just to contextualize all of these fundraisers, I mean, you've worked with the R&A team recently, haven't you, on secondaries investors fundraising data for 2023. What were the top line figures in that report?
Yes, that's right. So the biggest takeaway is that the secondaries market hit a new fundraising record last year. There was close to 118 billion raised across all asset classes, and that's more than double the amount raised in 2022. And by asset class, PE secondaries raked in nearly 100 billion, accounting for 85% of capital raised last year. That amount was nearly triple the 34 billion raised in PE secondaries in 2022.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Adam, maybe I can pull you in here because, you know, you've been covering the secondaries market for a long time. I think Hannah and I have come in when secondaries is all guns blazing and fundraising's been doing really well year over year. But what's your take on these record-breaking figures? There are a lot of them, so I'd be curious to know what you think.
That's a great question, Maddie. And it's worth reminding any listeners that, you know, if they want to delve deep into the figures, just head straight to secondariesinvestor.com. You can search for data. We have downloadable reports, interactive reports. It's all right there. So even the underlying data is downloadable too. So you can really get stuck into the weeds if you have an interest. What's my take? I mean, I guess looking at the actual figures of fundraising last year, I think private equity still accounts for the bulk of the capital raised. I think, Hannah, you just mentioned that 85% of the capital raised was for private equity. So, you know, everyone's talking about how secondaries is broadening out to different asset classes. That is true. And certainly lots of people have been talking about strategies such as private debt secondaries last year. But really, private equity and buyout accounts for the bulk of activity. You know, I think real estate also had a bit of a slow year last year, raising in the single digit billions. And infrastructure, you know, that is also an asset class that a lot of people have been talking about, especially as we came into 2024. There were at least three M&A activities in terms of purchases of primary direct infrastructure investors. lots of excitement and chatter on the secondary side. But looking at the actual fundraising figures, you know, we're still looking at sort of single digit billions raised for infrastructure secondaries. So by a wide margin, private equity is still accounting for the bulk of the capital.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually, Adam. And it was something that I brought up during my calls and speaking with people for these reports. I think what will be interesting to see is how those segments shift and continue to shift over the next few years. So if anyone has any hot takes that they want to share with us, please do reach out as always. But, you know, I think, as you say, it's interesting to have those conversations about how much specialized capital is coming into the secondaries market. But when you see the figures, it doesn't necessarily portray that excitement or the bullishness of the people that we speak to every day about these new pools of capital coming online.
So, Maddie, what interesting bits have you found in the reports that you looked over?
As you can imagine, Hannah, it was quite difficult. A lot of them are very specific, very well-researched. So there was a lot to sort of pick through, but I thought I would go with maybe some of the more specific findings that maybe we've talked to people about, but we haven't necessarily sort of seen hard data around. So let's start with Campbell Lutyens. I included this point in our web story, but I find it fascinating, so I think it's worth repeating. The use of deferrals in GP-led secondaries jumped last year, with 51% of all transactions using a method of delaying payments. That's up from just 6% in 2022. So pretty considerable increase there, to put it mildly. I spoke with Gerald Cooper, head of North America Secondaries Advisory at Campbell Lutyens, about this. So the use of deferrals in GP-leds looks similar to how it's used in LP-leds, pay some now, pay some later. The difference between them both is obviously in an LP-led transaction, the pension fund, for example, is the creditor, whereas in the GP-led transaction, the fund selling the assets is the creditor. So really interesting findings, and it makes sense, right? Buyers win because it can give them a boost to their IRR by, you know, utilizing this in a GP-led transactions. GPs can command higher pricing with the use of deferrals as well. According to Gerald, LPs are receptive to the idea or the use of it as far as his conversations have been going on. So as you sort of see more GPs looking for ways to create DPI for their LPs, LPs want to see that done in the right way, then, you know, the use of deferrals to make sure that sort of pricing expectations are aligned, everyone's sort of getting the best outcome of what they want out of a transaction like this. I expect you could probably see more of this year, or I do expect we'll see more of this year. I think the interesting thing to watch will be whether we see further jumps in that 51% figure over the next handful of months.
When we talk about deferrals, I guess for any listeners who may not be aware, I mean, it's allowing the buyer to pay a higher price, but they just pay, I guess, in installments, or they agree to pay at a later date, as far as I understand. I mean, you put it very succinctly, but buy now, pay later. Have you seen in any of the reports sort of what the average deferral time is? I mean, are we talking like 6 months down the line or like 2 years down the line?
On GP-leds, according to Gerald, it's sort of 6 to 12 months. So these aren't, you know, 24-month deferrals like you might see in some LP-led transactions. They're sort of like on a more relatively more narrow time frame that, you know, if you're thinking about this, that should be the way that you think of these averages.
Really interesting.
I also looked through PJT's report. There are a couple of points that I've pulled out from there as well. So the majority of respondents to PJT's report have been required to put more into their funds than simply rolling 100% of their carry. 43% of respondents made a 100% roll plus an incremental commitment. I checked in with Darren Schluter, managing director at PJT Park Hill, because I just wanted to make sure I understood those parameters. So incremental commit means additional dollars from the GP that is truly out of pocket. So for example, the GP is rolling all their carry into the deal, plus coming out of pocket for an additional X million. And that X million isn't coming from their latest flagship, it's from their personal capital. So more personal capital on top of more personal capital, basically. A further 18% of GPs rolled all of their capital and also made a new fund commitment as part of the deal. And then just 9% of GPs rolled less than 100% into their continuation fund transactions. I'd be curious to know what made that 9% so special that they got that through the negotiation period, because it certainly was something that I was told 100% carry roll is crucial for alignment in these transactions, particularly at a time where supply outstrips demand.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just picking out that 9% of GPs rolling less than 100%, I mean, just thinking out aloud, I'd be curious to know, so like 9% rolled less than 100%, but like, was that they rolled 99%? So they only, you know, they took 1% off the table, or did they roll like 50% and they took out 50%. I think that would be a big difference. That would be really interesting to look into. And then, you know, are we talking like really small, lower mid-market firms are able to do that because we're talking about smaller amounts of money, smaller deals, smaller fund sizes. We're not talking about the big listed blue chip asset managers being able to do that. And then, yeah, I guess I'd be curious as to whether the funds that these continuation funds were done on were already in carry, because maybe if they weren't in carry and then this deal brought the fund into carry, then I guess GP taking some chips off the table might be a bit different to if the fund was already in carry and then they ran a process and then they decided whether to take chips off the table. I feel like there are different dynamics that might kind of influence how LPs kind of interpret whether a GP is kind of able to kind of take some money off the table or whether they have to kind of reinvest it all. That would certainly be something interesting to look into.
Absolutely, Adam. Friday letter ideas galore there.
We're always after Friday letter ideas.
PJT also breaks down what they call structured liquidity solutions in their report. So the likes of NAV, PREF, GP commit financing, and LP interest financing. The vast majority of GPs haven't used these solutions, so 68% haven't tapped this area yet. Of those that have, 18% of GPs have used NAV loans, 9% have used GP commit financing, and 5% have used fund level preferred equity. I asked Darren what he thought of these findings, and he said to me the more interesting thing here is just the sheer amount of headroom there is for this market to grow. There's been so much emphasis on NAV loans to date, and he believes that will continue to grow, with the caveat here that as long as these NAV loans are mostly used for growth capital for portfolio companies. However, there's also growing interest in preferred equity transactions and GP commit financings based on the conversations PJT is currently having at the moment. However, there's still such a focus on DPI at the moment, and the use of NAV loans for DPI isn't something that LPs seem hugely keen on. When I was speaking with Gerald Cooper at Campbell Lutyens, he mentioned this was a reason why there was a heightened interest in multi-asset continuation funds. You can see the attraction there, create a liquidity event for multiple of your portfolio companies at once, rather than trying to sell a couple or all of them on the M&A market. That creates liquidity, it saves a lot of time, you're able to keep hold of those assets until such a time where you can exit them at the price you feel they're worth. So the logic follows. Let's see how much of this opportunity the secondaries buyer community is willing to pick up. And I know you have some additional specifics here, Adam.
Yeah, really interesting, Maddie. I mean, in Jefferies' annual report, it gives a data point which shows that multi-asset continuation funds took up a larger share of total continuation fund activity last year. So this was 59% of volume last year. That was up from 41% of volume the year prior. And I mean, just speaking to the people that we speak to in the market, you know, a lot of the buyers say that it's less risky investing in multi-asset continuation funds. You know, you are buying into a transaction that may have sort of 5 or 8 portfolio companies as opposed to just 1 portfolio company. So that's a lot less risky because it's more diverse. So there's less concentration risk. A buyer said to me last week that, you know, single asset continuation funds, pretty tricky, especially the large ones, pretty tricky to get done these days because there's only one buyer out there in the market and it's a 3-letter word buyer. I won't say who it is, but there's only one large buyer that can back these huge huge deals. And apart from that buyer, there's nobody else. All these deals have to be syndicated. So just some of the kind of dynamics underpinning the multi-asset continuation fund market.
Yeah, I wonder who that buyer is, Adam. It will remain a mystery forever.
Three letters, London listed. I'm sure listeners can figure it out from there.
Indeed.
I mean, speaking of that multi-asset and single asset dynamics, I'm curious in terms of the pricing, because compared to single asset vehicles, which often hold on to these trophy assets, these multi-asset vehicles often contain assets that are not completely the good quality ones, right? So what do you guys think the pricing could be like in multi-asset versus single asset deals in 2024?
It's a very interesting question that you pose there, Hannah. Interestingly, it was a point that was briefly brought up during our look forward stories of the year for secondaries investors. So HarbourVest's David Atterbury told me that he believed at that time there could be more multi-asset GP-led processes that come to market in 2024. Alongside the best assets for those transactions, he hypothesized that managers may look to create liquidity on some of their less good performers by including them in a continuation fund process as pressures to sell mount. I think while I can't answer that question specifically, I know it's anecdotally, we're often told, aren't we, that in multi-asset continuation funds, there is often a company or a couple of companies that are driving the continuation fund or maybe make up a larger share of that continuation fund. And then there's some smaller assets or maybe sort of less consequential assets alongside those more star performers, if you like. So I think, you know, logic follows that that could impact overall pricing for that continuation fund. But I guess maybe to just, again, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, within the context of the broader needs of GPs right now, primarily delivering DPI to their investors, I think the benefits of, you know, doing a multi-asset continuation fund to kind of create some sort of liquidity event for as many portfolio companies as possible, probably that outweighs the maybe negative of you would have got really good pricing on one single asset within that continuation fund in the current market. I've gone through the reports. Not every advisor has done this, but some or most of the advisors have given a forecast of where they expect activity to level out this year, or rather they've given their estimates for where deal volume could get to in 2024. Lazard expects $120 billion of volume this year. Campbell Lutyens anticipates that it could approach the $135 billion high that they have reported for 2021. Greenhill expects volume to edge closer to $134 billion. That was the record number that they reported for 2021. Couple more for you. PJT expects it to reach $135 billion plus, and Jefferies anticipates over $130 billion as well. Yeah, so some really interesting estimates. I think it will be obviously interesting to see if we get to that 2021, a record figure, which I think the secondaries market has been hoping will happen again in the near future, obviously where it makes sense for the market to do so. So yeah, Adam, we should think about a little reward that we can send to the firm that gets closest to the estimate at the end of the year. Maybe some incentive will make this interesting.
Well, why don't we invite them on to this podcast, and we can, whoever gets closer to that figure, we can have them on and we can, you know, crack open a beer and have a chat about what 2024 was like in the secondaries market.
I'll be sitting there with a Pinot Noir myself, but sounds brilliant. There you go. Your reward is a platform at the end of the year on the Second Thoughts podcast. So we look forward to seeing who that might be.
Thank you for tuning in to this edition of Second Thoughts. Stay tuned for Secondaries Investor's 10-year anniversary podcasts. We'll be in conversation with secondaries market heavyweights about the key changes in the secondaries market across the last decade and what the next 10 years could bring for this burgeoning area. As always, if you have any interesting tips for the podcast, do get in touch by sending me an email, madeline.f@pei.group. In the meantime, find all of your secondaries market news on secondariesinvestor.com. And to hear more episodes of Spotlight and our next breakdown of developments in the secondaries market, find us wherever you listen to podcasts or at any of PEI Group's various titles online. Thanks for listening.